This week we will be studying 1 Samuel 10, 17 through 27. The passage describes how Saul was presented before the people of Israel as their new king, whether he wanted the job or not. The passage will give us cause to consider the democratic process, the right to give a dissenting opinion, and the restraints placed on a king. If you have not yet read the passage, it is 1 Samuel 10, 17 through 27, and I recommend that you pause and read it now. Last week we considered 1 Samuel chapters 9 and 10. Those chapters told of how God directed Samuel to anoint Saul as king and of how he brought Saul to Samuel. We primarily considered the passage up to chapter 10, verse 17, which begins the account of what we might call Saul's coronation, or public presentation to the people of Israel. But before we jump into that passage, I want to take one step back to contemplate an interesting linguistic note from the previous passage, which we did not have time to consider last week. In the opening of chapter 10, Samuel anointed Saul to be leader over God's people. However, when he did so, he did not use the word king. Our English word king usually translates the Hebrew melech, and that is a word used by the Israelites in their demand for a king and in their coronation of one. However, when Samuel actually anointed Saul, he used a different word. The word Samuel used in chapter 10, verse 1, was nagid. That word implies something different than a king. According to blueletterbible.org, the word derives from the root verb nagad, which means to tell or declare something, particularly in the sense of standing before a group and announcing something. As a nagid, then, Saul was appointed to be the leader, the one who stands at the front and makes the proclamation before the people. Strong's defines the word as follows: a commander as occupying the front, civil, military, or religious. The English Standard Version translates the word prince while suggesting leader in the footnotes. The King James uses the word chief. In fact, as we look through chapter 10, we don't find Samuel using the word king to describe Saul anywhere. He uses the word to chastise the people for demanding a king, and the people use it to proclaim Saul king, but Samuel never uses it. In fact, even when he anointed David king in chapter 16, Samuel still did not use the word there either. I get the impression that Samuel was so repulsed by the idea of having a king that he couldn't even bring himself to say it. He would appoint a leader, someone who could stand at the front and proclaim the way to go, but he couldn't bear to appoint a king as a centrally empowered executive. That considered, let's move into the verses which will absorb most of our focus for today, chapter 10, verses 17 through 27. The passage opens with Samuel calling together the people of Israel at Mizpah. Mizpah, you may recall, is in Ephraim's territory, near the center of the map. It was in a mountainous region just north of the border with Benjamin. You may recognize Mizpah in that this was the home of Jephthah, a judge over Israel in Judges 11 and 12, and it was also Israel's base of operations during the Benjaminite War. Once the people arrived at Mizpah, Samuel began the ceremonies by chastising them. His chastisement came as a message from Jehovah. The message essentially was this: I rescued you from the king of Egypt, but you have rejected me and want another king, so now I'm going to give you one. These are more ominous words from Samuel, who was quite strenuous in his warning against a king. The last time Israel had a king was in Egypt, and the king of Egypt was certainly not good for them. With power centralized behind him, he had abused it by enslaving the people of Israel and killing their newborn sons to keep their numbers in check. Centralized power is a dangerous thing. Having warned them, Samuel commanded the people to present themselves by their tribes and their thousands. They would be ordered by their groups so that the Urim and Thummim could whittle those groups down by tribe and clan and family until eventually one winner of the lottery was selected as king. Now, how exactly the Urim and Thummim worked here is not entirely clear. The Hebrew words Urim and Thummim translated to English mean lights and perfections. These were kept in the breastpiece worn by the priest, and a good guess might be that they were black and white stones which were drawn to either give affirmative or negative answers. It is also suggested that they might be cast on the ground, and then, depending on the formation they landed in, they might be interpreted as selecting one of a variety of answers. We might think of them as a sort of divine drawing of the straws, or rolling of the dice, or shaking of the magic eight ball. The difference, of course, between this and those other random chance selectors is that the Urim and Thummim were guided by God's own hand. However exactly they worked, they were to be used to inquire directly of God to get his guidance, and God had approved them as his method of communicating with the people. We already know that Samuel had been given a message from God that Saul should be king, but here we see even more evidence of this. Saul won the lottery. The odds of Saul being pre-selected by Samuel and then winning this roll of the dice are very bad. For the tribe of Benjamin to be selected was a 1 in 12 chance. We don't know just how many clans of Benjamin there were at this point. In generations past, there had been 5, so I'd think that there were at least as many of them at this time. If we divide the odds by 5, then there was only a 1.6% chance of Saul's clan being chosen. How many families there were in that clan is unknown, but 1 Chronicles 9 lists 9 siblings in Kish's generation, presumably. If we supposed it was just 9, which I would think is a minimum, then we would have a 0.18% chance of choosing Saul's family. If Saul had only one brother, which would not be at all unreasonable to guess, then we would end up with a 0.09% chance of picking Saul, which is about 1 in 1,000. In all likelihood, there were more steps in this process and many more alternatives at each step than we give credit, so the odds of Saul winning are likely much worse than our calculation. But despite Saul's name having been entered into this lottery, when he won, he was nowhere to be found. After they had searched for him and not found him, they inquired again of God, asking if Saul had simply not yet arrived, saying, "Is there a man still to come?" The final answer came down that Saul was hiding among the baggage. Now, it is not clear how God answered the question. The Urim and Thummim were, if we understand them correctly, best used for choosing between multiple options like yes and no, or picking one of the 12 tribes. They would not, we suppose, be good at giving additional information, like where a person was hiding when that information wasn't provided as an option. But we don't have any clarity here that God spoke from the clouds with a booming voice or that Samuel heard a divine message. Maybe, once it had been established that Saul was in fact there somewhere, the Urim and Thummim were used to ask about various directions or parts of the assembly until the baggage area was selected. But however God said it, it was found to be true. Saul was indeed making a last-ditch effort to hide among the baggage to avoid being crowned king. This, I think, must have looked pretty silly, cowardly, and desperate. Too bad for Saul, he was found there, and when he was found, he had the physical look of a king. He was taller than everyone else, and he was handsome. He looked like a leader, a man like no one else. And so the people affirmed his kingship by shouting, "Long live the king!" I think we should note here that the people were excited about having Saul as king, seemingly only because of his looks. Obviously, how good-looking a person is has little to do with whether or not that person is a good leader. And yet, studies from around the world have determined that good-looking politicians are more likely to win elections. This apparently has a greater impact in elections in which voters have less information about the candidates running. However, there is still a boost for candidates perceived to be better-looking even in the most informed political races. It is still the case that, since the advent of televised presidential debates in 1960, over 70 years ago, the U.S. has not elected a president who is bald, nor one with facial hair, despite our expectation that these things would have little or no impact on a person's policies or capabilities as a leader. So I do urge you, if you vote for anything, please learn the policies of the candidates and don't vote based on looks. I doubt it does any better for us than it did for Israel. Verse 25 tells us that Samuel wrote the rights and duties of the king, that is, the laws which bound him, into a book and placed it before Jehovah, presumably at the tabernacle. We note here that the king was bound by laws. He was not all-powerful, and that the office of the king was clearly intended to be in submission to the religious order. Otherwise, we would not expect to find the laws kept at the tabernacle. With that, the meeting concluded. Some of the men, touched by God, as the passage tells us, were inspired to join Saul's service, apparently to form the beginnings of his administration and army. But some of the others put no faith in Saul and openly questioned how he could save them from Philistia. Saul ignored them and went home to Gibeah with his supporters. I think we should be clear that the selection of Saul as king was not a democratic process as we today contemplate a democratic process. There was not a number of candidates who put themselves up to run for office. There was no campaign or debate. The people didn't cast a vote for their favorite, and a winner wasn't selected based on the outcome of the vote. However, we do find here some kind of democratic process. The people, or at least some kind of representation of the people, came together. They agreed, in general, to accept the determination of the lottery. Once the lottery chose Saul as king, the majority of the people accepted him as their leader by shouting, "Long live the king," that being a voice affirmation vote. So in some sense, there was a vote here, or at the very least, there was a general consent of the governed to being governed. It does appear that this is a requirement for setting a king over God's people. Deuteronomy 17 suggests that a king would only be set over the people when the people insisted on having one, and the history here, in which the people demanded a king of Samuel and he acquiesced, sets a precedent that a legitimate king doesn't rule by force alone, nor only by theocratic decree, but by some combination of God's choice and the consent of the people. Another descriptive example of this might be found in 1 Kings 12. In that chapter, the northern tribes rejected the rule of Rehoboam, refusing to accept him as king after the death of his father Solomon. We have to be careful with that passage, though, because the decision of the people is not cast in a good light. They rejected the house of David and had trouble as a result for generations thereafter, leading eventually to their annihilation. However, while their decision was not a good decision, the passage does suggest that they had a right to make a choice. We also note in this passage an essential of any functioning democratic society: the right to hold and express a dissenting opinion. Verse 27 tells that not everyone wanted Saul as king. Some of the people were evidently unimpressed with his stature and didn't approve of his hiding among the baggage. And while the passage casts them as worthless men, which they certainly were, we can't say that they were altogether wrong in this. Saul did end up being a bad king. However, worthless as these people may have been, Saul did not punish them for expressing their opinion that he would not be a good king. He didn't punish them on this day, nor did he punish them on any other. These same naysayers show up again in the next chapter. In 1 Samuel 9, 12-13, the people call for those who had previously spoken against Saul to be put to death, but Saul refused to do this. Saul's kingdom respected dissenting opinions. This is not the only passage of Scripture which suggests to us the necessity of allowing people generally free speech. One of my favorite examples comes from Jeremiah chapter 26. In that chapter, Jeremiah delivered a prophetic message against the sitting government, calling the people to repentance and warning them of impending disaster if they should fail to repent. The priests and the people threatened to put Jeremiah to death, but when the matter was brought before the judges, they refused to penalize Jeremiah, affirming that he had a right to give a dissenting opinion and that his opinion, while unpopular, could in fact be essential to delivering the people from disaster. We note also that passages endorsing free speech aside, there is no justification in the law which would permit a person to penalize someone else for delivering a dissenting opinion, so governmental leaders can have no right to do so, blasphemy being the exception to the rule. An allowance of generally free speech is essential to the functioning of a healthy society. Dissenters must be permitted to give their dissent. In selecting a leader, it is important that both the pros and cons of selecting that leader be thoroughly weighed, and this means that someone must bring to light the candidate's weakness. Once a leader comes to power, he won't always know the best way or act the best way, even when he does know it. To keep leaders on the best path, people must be allowed to criticize these leaders. We will never know the best ideas if we only allow people to talk about the most popular ideas or the most favored ideas, because the best ideas in many cases will be neither popular nor favored. The person who offers a dissenting opinion is not to be viewed as an enemy. He is to be viewed as a friend who seeks to serve our best interest by pointing out the pit so that we will not accidentally fall into it. Proverbs 27:6 tells us, "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, profuse are the kisses of an enemy." Your enemy, then, is not the person who presents a contrary idea to you. Your enemy is the one who withholds his criticism of you. He flatters you to gain your favor while at the same time allowing you to follow a path to ruin. Your friend, however, is the one who cares enough about you that he will rebuke you and ensure that you stay on the right path. Even if his words seem to hurt, he is the better friend. The Proverbs also warn us against the folly of pride. Proverbs 16:18 tells us that pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. It takes a certain amount of pride to believe that you have all the answers, and that no one else ought to be a voice contrary to your opinion, and indeed that kind of thinking will cause us to bypass the truth to our peril. It is better for us that we should have enough humility to listen to alternate points of view and consider whether our preconceived ideas might be incorrect. And this is as true in the church as it is in the political realm. We don't penalize our Christian brothers for valid disagreement here. Note the word valid. There are ideas which would be so far outside the scriptural norm as to be wholly invalid. But this openness to opinions is one of the things which significantly distinguishes our congregation from many others. Once the sermon has been preached, we open the floor for comments, including comments which are dissenting and critical. And indeed, 1 Corinthians 14, in describing the properly functioning church, calls for multiple men to speak. The church is not supposed to be a one-man show. I think that we also need to note in today's passage, 1 Samuel 10:25, which reads in part, "Samuel told the people the rights and duties of the kingship, and he wrote them in a book and laid it up before the Lord." I want to make sure we're very clear on this point. The king did not have absolute power. Unfortunately, some have contorted today's passage to suggest as much. They will point out that the king was chosen by God and anointed for the work, and they will presume, therefore, that by divine right, the king can do essentially anything that he pleases. But this is wild error. The passage makes very clear that the king had certain rights. The people ceded some power to him, and in doing so, they empowered him to do certain things on their behalf. However, the king did not have a right to do anything that he wanted. Indeed, he could not possibly derive from the people any power that the people themselves did not already in some measure possess. There is nothing which it is wrong for the people to do which suddenly becomes morally acceptable for the king to do, simply because the power of the people has been aggregated behind him. The king simply has more ability to do the good things that are already acceptable for people to do. And of course, the counterbalance to a right to act is a duty to act. The king, because he had absorbed the collective power of the people to act, had a duty to act in certain cases and a duty to restrain his actions in other cases. Once given the power to enforce the law, the king would be required to do so. He could not rightly neglect to enforce the law, for example, in a case where his close friend would be penalized. And many other such examples could be given. The point is that it is nowhere the intent of the scriptures that a king should be unbound to simply do as he pleases. God has given moral bounds to mankind which no one, not even a king, can rightly transgress, and in this case, we see particularly that the laws were written down, indicating to us that they were definite. They were not malleable. They were on record so that anyone with access to the document could see them. They could be applied to the king, and the king could be held to account. So, if someone tries to tell you that the intent of the Bible is that we should be unquestioningly subservient to any person who is presented as being in a position of authority, do not fall for that heresy. Government officials are not empowered to alter the immutable standards of right and wrong, and if they will refuse to submit to that higher power, then they themselves become rebels and lawbreakers, as Romans 13 teaches. The only governance that the Bible endorses is accountable, limited governance, acting under God's authority and in conformity with this book. To conclude, then, 1 Samuel 10 tells us how Saul was presented before the people and how they accepted him as their king. Just as we saw in last week's message, so we saw again this week that Saul didn't really want to be king, and also that he could not avoid it. Clearly, as evidenced by the Urim and Thummim, God had chosen Saul for the job. But while God had chosen Saul, the people also affirmed his choice. The people chose to put their power behind the king. They didn't necessarily do it for the right reasons. We get the impression that they were much more concerned with optics than with substance, not unlike much of politics today. And as in any democratic process, there were dissenting opinions. Those opinions were permitted, as they should be. The king, once he was elected, was bound to uphold the laws of God, and he was so bound in writing. This gives a good example for governance in the modern day. We expect that any legitimate government should be limited with clearly prescribed bounds, bounds which are in harmony with the scriptures.
For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.